It's Tuesday, January 19th, 2021. My name is Rich Sabata, and this is the Fight for Our Health. I remember the first time I really thought about climate change. I was sitting in my sixth grade English class, and my teacher started talking about the tragedy happening in New Orleans. It was 2004. George Bush was president. I remember watching videos of people who looked like me and my friends climbing their houses because their entire neighborhood was underwater. I had nightmares for weeks, but I remember my teacher briefly telling us about how climate change created a powerful storm like Hurricane Katrina that damaged and caused the levees to fail. Levees, a symbol and a structure for human conquering of Mother Nature. And then,
George Bush doesn't care about black people.
Hurricane Katrina became a global symbol of how climate change, climate policy, can disproportionately affect people of color. This, in my adult life, has led me to consider the fight for climate justice. Environmental racism refers to the unequal access to a clean environment and basic environmental resources based on race. Communities of color are disproportionately victimized by environmental hazards and are far more likely to die and live in areas with heavy pollution. People of color are more likely to die of environmental causes, and more than half of the people who live close to hazardous waste are people of color. Some activists call environmental racism the new Jim Crow, as it subjects communities of color to inequitable living conditions. This goes back to beliefs initially perpetuated by institution of slavery, when enslaved Africans were considered disposable because they were sent to work in conditions deemed too dangerous for white workers. The authorities in the United States, as well as institutions in place, often treat areas that are home to minority residents as less value than wealthy and predominantly white neighborhoods. The burdens of pollution, toxic waste, and poisoned resources are not distributed equally across society. The fact of the matter is, if you're black, you are more likely to live in an environmentally toxic environment than you were if you were white. And with environmental racism comes environmental justice, or climate justice. Environmental justice is a social justice movement that seeks to dismantle the flawed environmental policies that have long harmed low-income communities and communities of color, and instead pursue policy and development that works to create sustainable, cooperative, and equitable future for the environment. It rests on the principle that everyone has the right to a clean and healthy environment. And the environmental justice movement strives to attain that. It also seeks to remedy the ills of environmental racism and give everyone a livable future. This movement initially began in the late 1980s when a report was published, Toxic Waste and Race, that proved communities of color were subject to environmental degradation and dangerous pollution. But there's a great and rich history here. So my friends at ProPublica put this little clip together.
Nationally, the facilities where we dump our garbage and process dangerous chemicals tend to be located in poor and minority communities. The people who live there have little or no protection from the industries around them, and things could get worse. So there's this idea of environmental justice. It's pretty simple. Communities shouldn't be forced to deal with more pollution because they belong to a certain race, national origin, or income bracket. Yet America has struggled over the years to implement any serious policy that actually protects these communities. So let's lay out the ways the government has failed them.
We will not allow one county to become a dump site.
The fight for environmental justice took off in 1982, when residents of Warren County, North Carolina, mounted mass demonstrations against a plan to dump contaminated soil in a landfill in their community. The EPA investigated four similar landfills in southern states and found that they were all located in Black or low-income neighborhoods. In 1987, the United Church of Christ Racial Justice Commission found that around the country, hazardous waste facilities were more likely to be located in mostly minority communities. Amid mounting proof, the federal government was forced to act.
I, George Herbert Walker Bush.
So in 1992, President George H.W. Bush founded the Office of Environmental Justice inside the EPA. 2 years later, President Bill Clinton signed an executive order requiring federal agencies to consider environmental justice in all of their policies, as well as extending civil rights protection to environmental discrimination. But Congress never passed a bill to make Clinton's executive order law. Then came George W. Bush. His administration shifted the focus of the Office of Environmental Justice from protecting low-income and minority communities to all people, leaving vulnerable populations without a federal environmental advocate.
80% of New Orleans, including much of downtown, is underwater.
Under Bush, many environmental civil rights claims were rejected or delayed for years. In 2009, after President Barack Obama's election, his administration recommitted to environmental justice.
Generally speaking, in this country, a lot of environmentally problematic facilities tend to be located in places where poor folks live.
Yet, during the 2 years Democrats controlled the House, the Senate, and the White House, they didn't file a single bill focused on strengthening environmental justice protections. Passing major environmental legislation faded further when Republicans took control of Congress in the 2010 midterm elections. Now, President Donald J. Trump is making good on his vow to weaken the EPA.
Environmental protection, what they do is a disgrace. Every week they come out with new regulations. They make it
Who's
impossible.
Who's going to protect the environment?
They will be fine with the environment. We can leave a little bit.
This budget, a 31% cut to the EPA, $2.6 billion cut away from the EPA. That's what the president wants.
As the EPA loses funding and regulations are rolled back, vulnerable communities may very likely fall through the cracks.
Thanks, guys. That's really just the start. The more and more digging I did into this stuff, the more that I realized that sometimes the biggest threats are threats you can't even see. Here's the deal with air quality. Annually, the United States oil and gas industry releases about 9 million tons of methane and other toxic chemicals into the atmosphere. Black and low-income communities are disproportionately affected by air pollution in the United States. For example, more than 1 million Black people live within a half mile of natural gas facilities. Over 1 million Black Americans face a cancer risk above the EPA level of concern due to unclean air. And more than 6.7 million African Americans live in the 91 U.S. counties with oil refineries. In total, African Americans are 75% more likely than white people to live in fence-lined communities, or areas near commercial facilities that produce noise, odor, traffic, or emissions that directly affect the population. Additionally, exposure to poor air quality can cause numerous health problems, such as asthma. Approximately 13.4% of African American children suffer from asthma as compared to 7.3% of white children. And the government response to concerns over air quality is also vastly different between communities of different races and ethnicities. From October 2015 to February 2016, the affluent suburban Los Angeles neighborhood of Porter Ranch experienced the worst reported methane leak in the United States. Porter Ranch is predominantly white neighborhood, with house prices in the $400,000 range and above. Shortly after the leak, a state of emergency was declared and over 4,000 homes were evacuated. Additionally, the city of Los Angeles ordered the gas company to provide temporary housing for the evacuated individuals. On the other hand, Jefferson Park, a neighborhood in South Los Angeles, is located near an oil drilling site and contains a population that is over 90% African American or Latinx. The Alien Co. drilling site in Jefferson Park was finally closed in 2013 after EPA officials became sick after investigating the site. However, since the site opening in 2010 up until its closing, 251 complaints have been filed to the South Coast Air Quality Management by community members. In response, only 15 citations were filed by the agency against Alien Co. Then comes in ocean acidification. Ocean acidification occurs when the natural pH of ocean water is lowered due to the increased CO2 levels. I didn't know this, but the ocean absorbs about 30% of CO2 released into the atmosphere. These molecules then undergo a series of chemical reactions that release a surplus of hydrogen ions, which lowers the pH of the water. Ocean acidification affects natural plant and animal life, which can negatively impact humans who rely on the ocean for food, economic, and other purposes. For example, oysters, clams, and scallops accounted for nearly $400 million in the United States, and an increase in ocean acidification can cost the industry nearly $480 million. These risks are amplified in communities such as coastal Native American tribes, whose diet and economy rely on seafood. For example, the Quinault Tribe of Washington own the Quinault Pride Food, Land, and Timber Enterprises. The tribe has detailed accounts of an increased number of dead fish washing ashore due to low oxygen levels in the rivers. Additionally, tourism and hunting in the Arctic are large contributors to the economy and greatly help indigenous communities of the area. The sport fishing industry is affected by ocean acidification, which causes a decline in revenue for indigenous populations. Lastly, it's the most obvious one, and one of the most notable effects of climate change is the occurrence of natural disasters. As global temperatures rise, more water vapor is stored in the atmosphere, resulting in more rain and powerful storms. Warmer air, another factor of rising temperatures, also causes faster wind speeds during tropical storms. After a natural disaster hits a community, government aid is typically sent to the area to rebuild infrastructure and restore the city. However, the dispersal of aid is one way in which minorities and low-income communities are hurt by natural disasters. In one study done by Rice University and the University of Pittsburgh, it found that white counties saw an increase in average wealth after natural disasters, while predominantly minority counties saw wealth decrease. The study notes that white communities saw higher levels of reinvestment in their communities after natural disasters in comparison to their minority counterparts. Additionally, it was found that white families and communities with significant damage from natural disasters saw an increase in wealth due to generous reinvestment initiatives. However, minority families in communities with similar damage from natural disasters saw a smaller increase in wealth, or they actually saw a decrease in wealth. White families living in the areas with about $100,000 in damage saw wealth increase of about $26,000. White families living in areas with about $10 billion in damages saw wealth increase of nearly $126,000. Conversely, Black families living in areas with about $100,000 in damages saw wealth increase by $19,000. Black families living in areas with about $10 billion saw a decrease of wealth by $27,000. Furthermore, low-income Americans are more likely to suffer from the consequences of tropical storms due to inadequate infrastructure and lack of proper insurance. Low-income and minority populations are also more likely to live near industrial facilities and are therefore at a higher risk for chemical spills and toxic leaks resulting from the tropical storms. For example, 60% of African Americans in Baltimore live within 1 mile of a toxic release industry, and 70% of African Americans live within 2 to 4 miles of one. But those are just the issues. Here's really the big and major real policy fight in order to combat all of this and to try to correct for such a deep, dark history. You might have heard of a thing called the Green New Deal. The Green New Deal is a congressional resolution to mobilize every aspect of American society to 100% clean and renewable energy. Guarantee living wage jobs for anyone who needs one, and a just transition for both workers and frontline communities all in the next 10 years. But here are the real folks who are experts in this to talk about it.
For the first time ever, we have a plan to tackle some of the most urgent crises of our time.
The Green New Deal.
It's been put forward by Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Sunrise Movement,
and Justice Democrats.
Here's what it is.
The Green New Deal calls for achieving net zero carbon emissions by 2030.
Guaranteeing everyone a good job and providing targeted investment in low-income communities and communities of color.
That means upgrading every building and mode of transportation in this country.
And upgrading our entire power grid to achieve maximal energy efficiency.
Leading climate scientists have said that the only historic parallel to the kind of mass mobilization we need to avoid economic and climate disaster
is the mass economic plan the United States underwent to build arms for World War II.
A mobilization that created the modern American middle class.
That's why the Green New Deal is not just another climate policy.
Like FDR's New Deal, it is a call to redefine politics and establish a new social contract for America.
In line with the economic and ecological realities of the 21st century.
It is one where no matter the color of your skin,
where your parents are from,
or how much money you make,
you are entitled to basic rights.
To a good job transforming our country.
To clean air, water, and food.
And to a stable climate able to sustain human civilization.
It is about firmly saying no one should have to live in fear of losing the people and places they love to a crisis that we have the power to stop.
The original New Deal created the greatest middle class America has ever seen.
But many of its promises were deliberately kept away from people of color and women.
Today, the youngest, most diverse, and most female working class deserves a renewed investment that allowed so many Americans to prosper in the 20th century.
The UN's IPCC report last October, by the world's top climate scientists, laid out in stark terms how we have 12 years to transform our economy and society to preserve the stable climate that human civilization depended on for millennia.
We don't rise to the challenge. The wildfires, hurricanes, and heat waves that claimed thousands of American lives in the past few years will claim millions of lives within our lifetimes.
The science is clear.
The solutions are ready, overwhelmingly popular, and would create millions of good jobs.
Now politicians have a choice.
Will they find the courage to stand up to the fossil fuel billionaires who bankroll both parties?
Or will they choose to condemn millions of people to a future without the livable planet human civilization has depended on for millennia?
The Green New Deal is gaining momentum. Hundreds of organizations and politicians have already endorsed it, and nearly all of the major Democratic presidential contenders in 2020 say they back the idea.
Now they all have an opportunity to back up their words by sponsoring this resolution.
That's what any politician who wants to be taken seriously on climate and economic policy will do.
It's time for a Democratic Party that fights for big solutions that match the scale of our crises.
Climate change.
Skyrocketing inequality. inequality,
and deepening structural racism.
We're going to be taking the fight for a Green New Deal to every corner of America. We're going on a 15-city tour and a 50-state campaign starting in early primary states to build the political and public support for the Green New Deal.
If you're a Democrat running for president or for Congress,
we're calling on you to co-sponsor and support AOC's Green New Deal.
While we're still fighting for the Green New Deal to actually take place, it faced a lot of opposition from Republicans in Congress, and a lot of their gripes about it were the sheer cost. But oftentimes, the thing about the Green New Deal is that it involves reshaping the way we think about every aspect about our economy. Now, obviously, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is only in the House, and that's a huge deal, and it's amazing. But the real fight oftentimes has to take place all the way at the top, which is why I wanted to take some time to talk about the plan laid out by soon-to-be President Joe Biden. Here's Joe Biden, in his own words, talking about his plan.
Nothing gives me more hope for the future than seeing my five grandchildren challenge expectations. They see breakthroughs in technology we can't even yet imagine. But the only way they're going to get a chance to fulfill all that potential is if we take drastic action right now to address the climate disaster facing the nation and our world. More severe storms and droughts, rising sea levels, warming temperatures, shrinking snow cover and ice sheets. It's already happening. And science tells us that how we act or fail to act in the next 12 years will determine the very livability of our planet. Yet today, President Trump denies the evidence in front of his own eyes, hides climate science produced by his own administration, and actively works to roll back what progress we've already made. It's reckless, it's irresponsible, and it is unacceptable. So today, I'm announcing my plan for a clean energy revolution. It outlines what we have to do to meet this challenge head on and how we're going to get there. We're going to invest $1.7 trillion in securing our future so that by 2050, the United States will be 100% clean energy economy with net zero emissions. By the end of my first term, we will have an enforcement mechanism in place to make sure we stay on track to get there. You know, we're going to make record-breaking investments in research and development, zero-carbon technologies, so that America is the engine of the world's clean energy economy, exporting cutting-edge equipment stamped made in the USA to help other nations reduce emissions and mitigate and adapt. This initiative will create more than 10 million new good-paying jobs all across the clean economy in the United States of America. It's an enormous opportunity. We'll hold polluters accountable for the damage they've caused, particularly in low-income communities and communities of color, not only due to climate change, but the pollution they are pumping into the air that is breathed and the water that is drunk in those communities. You know, we're not going to forget the workers either. The workers who, through dangerous and back-breaking labor, powered our industrial rise, mined and built our arsenal of democracy, and fueled America's prosperity through the 20th century. They've earned our thanks, our respect, and our support. Finally, we have to bring the world along with us. Global action requires American leadership. But the United States only accounts for 15% of global carbon emissions. The rest of the world has to step up as well. So on day one, I will immediately rejoin the Paris Climate Accord. But that's not sufficient. We need to dramatically accelerate our worldwide effort to meet the intensity of the challenge we face. So I'll immediately get to work, leading a diplomatic initiative to get every nation to go beyond their initial commitment, to push our progress further and faster. This is especially true for China, by far the world's largest emitter of carbon. We will not only hold their leaders accountable for reducing carbon output at home in their country, but make sure they stop financing billions of dollars of dirty fossil fuel projects all across Asia. And this will allow us to keep creating good-paying jobs right here at home, even as we raise our own standards. America once again will be able to stand proudly on the world stage and challenge every other nation to follow our example and our leadership. For more than three decades, I've led in this issue. I wrote one of the first climate change bills ever introduced in the United States Senate. As vice president, I oversaw the single largest investment in clean energy in our nation's history, over $90 billion. I fought along with President Obama to double the efficiency of our cars, which would reduce our oil consumption by 12 billion barrels, and for a clean power plant that limited carbon emissions from both existing and new power plants. As president, I will lead America and the world, not only to confront the crisis in front of us, but to seize the opportunities it presents. I'll use every authority available to me to drive progress, and I will not accept half measures, because making these revolutionary changes is going to take an incredible commitment at all levels, but I am absolutely confident that's what the American people want to do, and we can meet this challenge, because this is what America does best. Solve big problems with big ideas. That's who we are. That's who we've been. We're the United States of America, and there's not a single thing we cannot do. And the world badly needs us to do it.
So, there you have it. Two major plans to try to transform the way the United States thinks about climate, the way we treat climate, and the way we think about how climate has long affected communities of color. But those were obviously both campaign videos. So how do these plans actually compare when you look at them side by side? So the Green New Deal resolution calls for the launch of a 10-year national mobilization to reduce carbon emissions in the United States. It envisions sourcing 100% of the country's electricity from renewable and zero emissions power, building or upgrading to smart power grids, creating millions of high-wage jobs in the green economy, overhauling infrastructure with electric vehicles and public transport, including high-speed rail, upgrading all existing buildings to achieve maximum energy efficiency, building resiliency against climate change-related issues, restoring forests to remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere, working with farmers to cut emissions from the agricultural sector. The Green New Deal also seeks to address the social inequality and proposes strengthening the right of workers to organize and unionize. It calls for all Americans to be provided with high-quality healthcare, affordable and safe housing, as well as clean water and air. In its current form, the Green New Deal is a non-binding resolution, and the costs of the project are unclear. Representative Ocasio-Cortez said it would cost at least $10 trillion, while Donald Trump put the figure at about $100 trillion. The amount the president cited is rounded up from an estimate by conservative think tank Action Group Forum, which said it could cost between $51 trillion and $93 trillion. But supporters of the Green New Deal say that the climate crisis could be equally or more costly to the U.S. economy. On the other hand, we have President-elect Biden's climate plan, and by all intents and purposes, it's the boldest of any president in history. But it doesn't go as far, or it isn't as ambitious as the Green New Deal. While the Green New Deal proposes achieving net zero greenhouse gas emissions across the economy by 2030, President Biden's aims to reach this milestone by 2050. He has also repeatedly pledged not to abolish fracking as a set of techniques for recovering oil and gas from shale rock. The president-elect tread carefully around the issue during his election campaign, as the fracking industry provides thousands of jobs in key battleground states like Pennsylvania. Among Mr. Biden's climate change proposal is a $2 trillion investment in clean energy to create carbon-free electricity by 2035. He also plans to improve energy efficiency in buildings and housing and promote the production of electric vehicles and conservation efforts in the agricultural industry. The climate plan includes a requirement that 40% of the money spent on clean energy deployment, reduction of legacy pollution, and other investments go to historically disadvantaged communities. Mr. Biden has also vowed to immediately rejoin the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement on the first day of his presidency. The International Pact to limit global heating to well below 2 degrees Celsius. As I'm recording this, it's a couple days before the inauguration of President Biden. And it's very clear from a lot of his dialogue that climate is going to be a great and severe part of his presidency beyond handling the coronavirus pandemic. And it's something that we as communities of color need to make sure that we're constantly advocating for, along with things such as police reform that also affect our health. Because issues of the planet are going to affect us for a very long time. And even if some of the more drastic potential causes and effects of climate change don't take place until 20, 30 years from now, that comes a lot sooner than you think, and our children and grandchildren will be dealing with a planet that is not only severely suffering from issues of climate change, communities of color will be further down the road on this same issue of environmental racism, and it's only going to get worse if we don't do anything about it. If you found this episode informational, helpful, and you want to share with someone, go ahead and do so. It helps our podcast grow. Make sure to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to your podcasts. If you have any questions for me or any future topics that you'd like to hear me talk about, please reach out at rich@bodegabody.com. And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Rich Cebada. That's Rich, C-E-B-A-D-A. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.